Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands, the UN reports demolition and confiscation of Palestinian homes in the West Bank and Al-Quds have increased by 21% compared to the year before. The Yemeni army releases footage of its latest games against Soudalat mercenaries in Marib province. Lhasa and gunfire in Afghan capital. At least 25 people are killed in an attack on the biggest military hospital in central Kabul. Top story of this hour, Israeli land grab policy in the occupied Palestinian territories continues unabated, according to a UN body. Demolition and confiscation of homes in the West Bank and Al-Quds have risen by 21% compared to the previous year. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs also reported a 28% rise in the number of Palestinians displaced in the same period. Over 310 structures have been seized only in Area C without any advance warning or on short notice. Area C accounts for more than 60% of the occupied West Bank. Palestinians say the demolitions are part of the regime's land grab policy aimed at expanding settlements. Israel has recently unveiled plans to build over 3,000 more settler units in the West Bank. Now from Hasselt, let's bring in Bresh Youngers, who's a historian and journalist. Good to have you with us, Bresh. So, as you see, more and more Palestinian land is being grabbed by the Tel Aviv regime. And this is despite the fact that thanks to social media and also some of the alternative media, maybe I can mention Press TV too, people around the world are learning more about what the Tel Aviv regime is doing to the Palestinians. So what's the reason behind this, despite this knowledge?
Well, I think it is important to understand whenever we're talking about the Zionist entity that this is in its very essence, by definition, a movement and an entity now, ever since 1948, an entity that in the guise of a state that is built on the very principle of settler colonialism, on colonization, and on land theft. That is what they do. And the ethnic cleansing that comes along with it is something they gladly have taken upon themselves to undertake in order to achieve this nearly apocalyptic goal that they have, that is the nearly, basically the wiping clean of the slate of what is known as Palestine, in order for them to build their Eretz Israel, as they call it. So when you see now, of course, that Israel has approved over 3,000 more colonial homes and settlements, and illegal settlements, in the West Bank, in areas that they previously agreed upon in 1993 in the Oslo Accords, so were not theirs at all. Even the Zionist government back then agreed that they would abide with the fact that both the Gaza Strip as the West Bank and East Jerusalem were not theirs to take. But they took it anyway. This is something that I think it needs to be always remembered when we're talking about the Zionists. Yes, they have patience. They work slowly but surely sometimes, and they have no qualms with taking their time and biding their time and see what they can take bit by bit, because their goal is something long term. Their goal is the complete erasure of the Palestinian people, the complete erasure of the Arab nation in this area, of what they see as Arab invaders. So, whereas in reality, the Palestinians are most likely more ethnically related to the Hebrews of old than the majority of the Jewish settlers and colonial immigrants are that are living there now. But in their mind, they need to erase the population from the face of the earth, or at least of the face of the map of Palestine, in order to build their new country. This is very similar to what happened in the United States, and that's why the United States is, of course, a major backer of Israel. The history of the United States is very similar in a way, in which a complete population that existed already was wiped out, and the state was wiped clean in order to build up a new society. And that's why you see that this Area C system still exists. More than almost 30 years after the Oslo Accords, we still have over 60% of the West Bank. I'm not talking 60% of Palestine, but 60% of the West Bank is by itself already occupied still being controlled both militarily and economically by the Zionist settlers. And this is where all the Zionist settlements are being built. And whenever anyone protests, they are repressed and shot by the IDF, by the Zionist aggression forces, because this area is still, despite almost 30 years of Oslo Accord, is still de facto under Israeli control.
Mm-hmm. Right. Bryce, negotiations have not worked. The so-called deal of the century that the U.S. proposed is totally biased. And also, international organizations, they couldn't do much. And Palestinians are losing more and more land and also their rights. So what's the way forward for them?
The only way forward that the Palestinians are left with is the path of resistance. And this is something we have seen recently. We've seen this last spring and last summer at when the tensions flared up again, that it is no longer just the movements that in the West would be called quote-unquote extremists that are taking up weapons and fighting back. It's no longer just Hamas in Gaza that is fighting militarily, but you see the movements of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, and even the more radical fractions of the Fatah organization that are rising up and have dared to recently shoot back. That's what, unfortunately, this is what we have gotten to. Resistance at a certain point is the only option you are left with. If the enemy does not allow you to live in your own land peacefully, to live in your own land and elect your own rulers, to live in your own land and live by your own laws, by your own that are voted by your own representatives, then the only thing you can do is resist. And unfortunately, if your enemy, like in this case the Zionist entity, is one of the most heavily armed and high-tech societies in the world, then the only thing you can do is, you know, grab weapons and fight back. We have seen that, I've said before, that since 1993, de facto, the majority of Palestinian lands, even the West Bank and East Jerusalem, have de facto remained occupied. There is only one area in all of Palestine where the Zionists do not dare enter, and that is not in the West Bank. It is definitely not East Jerusalem. It's not even Ramallah, the capital of the Palestinian Authority, but it is Gaza. And the reason why they don't dare enter in Gaza is because the Gazan resistance has given them so much trouble and has fought back so hard that by 2005, the Zionists have decided to withdraw. Since 2007, the Zionists have been surrounding them, blockading them, and trying to starve them in the submission. And so far, we are now 2021, that blockade is still ongoing, and the people of Gaza have still not surrendered.
Right.
And during all that time, yes, there have been bombings, but there have not been large-scale in military invasions, because they do not dare to take on the people of Gaza, let alone colonial encroachment in Gaza. There are no colonies in Gaza anymore since 2005, and the reason for that is because the people of Gaza are not afraid to take the weapons when necessary, and their elected representatives, the majority of whom are from Hamas, credit where credit is due, they are willing to really take their cause to heart and really say, we are elected to represent the people of Palestine, and we will not allow any Zionist encroachment on the land. This is the only way in which the Zionists can listen, just like the only way to make the Americans listen was militarily defeating them, like happened in Afghanistan and Iraq and in Syria. This is the same thing that is going on here. The Palestinians, unfortunately, have no other way but to fight back, and they are doing so. And that is why you see that the Zionists are getting ever more and more scared, because they feel like their slow but steady plan of colonization and of bribing their way into getting the Palestinians to leave or to integrate, quote-unquote, to such an extent that they are no longer Palestinians, that plan is no longer working. The people of Palestine are rising up more and more, and even their political leaders are starting to understand this and are starting to represent this spirit of resistance on the streets, in the parliament, and in the military forces. And this is the only way, at this point, I believe, that the Palestinian people have any hope for their very survival.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Bryce Junkers, historian, journalist, and Hasselt. The Yemeni army says it's conducted fresh raids against Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries fighting in central parts of Yemen. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the raids were conducted against enemy hideouts in Baida and Nara provinces during the second phase of an operation called Spring of Victory. The raids included attacks on Saudi soil. The army and allied Ansarullah fighters managed to fully liberate Baida, located next to oil-rich Marib. The general said that Juba and Jabal Murad districts in Marib are now in the control of the army. Narab is the last stronghold of Saudi and UAE-backed forces. The Yemeni army has promised to continue the operations until the country is fully liberated and the Saudi-led coalition stops the war. Lebanon has invited Saudi Arabia to dialogue to ease the recent tensions between the two countries. Analysts, however, see that issue is not merely about the statements made by the Lebanese information minister who called on the Saudi regime to stop its war on Yemen.
With the socioeconomic crisis deepening in Lebanon, the Saudi regime is not making things any easier. Riyadh's reaction to comments by Lebanese Information Minister Josh Kordahi, who had decried the Saudi war on Yemen, is a stick being used against the Lebanese government. The main question is, will he step down?
Concerning Mr. Kordahi, it is obvious now that he is not going to resign because he is not resembling himself. He is resembling a huge national bloc that is backing him because it's a matter of the Lebanese dignity here. We are not going to let the Saudis succeed in their blackmailing moves against Lebanon.
But analysts believe the Saudi Crown Prince is trying to get concessions from Lebanon in return for funding the economic reform plan. Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib told Agence France-Presse that he had invited the Saudis to the negotiating table in a bid to solve all the outstanding problems. Saudi Arabia is an Arab country, he said, which has historic brotherly ties with Lebanon, but then severed diplomatic ties without holding any talks. Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati is also holding talks with other Arab states in COP20 in Glasgow to see whether the diplomatic row can be eased. Now, observers say it all has to do with how the Americans deal with the Saudis.
The main issue is between Riyadh and Washington. Once the situation between Washington and Riyadh is solved, I think the crisis will be solved in Lebanon. And the pressure the Saudis are exerting on Lebanon is going to soften. But up till now, it seems that Mikati is having the backing of Washington and Paris because, as I said, they both want this government to remain.
While the crisis resulting from Minister Kordahi's statements remains high, the Saudis themselves have declared that their campaign against Lebanon is a much bigger issue. Their ultimate goal in the last couple of decades seemed to have been detaching Hezbollah from the Lebanese political scene. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The UK and France are split in a bitter row over fishing rights. Paris is now postponing a set of scheduled sanctions targeting London, though, so that they can negotiate and figure out a solution. The two Western allies have not been on the best of terms since September, when a submarine deal involving London sidelined Paris. And the fallouts from Brexit are also complicating things, the fishing route being just one of them.
The United Kingdom and France have gotten into a bitter diplomatic row. The two countries have been at odds over post-Brexit fishing rights in the British territorial waters. The UK gives out licenses to foreign vessels wishing to fish in its waters, but Paris says some fishing boats have been denied permission to enter areas they have fished in for years. London says the licenses have been distributed according to the post-Brexit deal it reached with the European Union last December. The dispute escalated to the point where a British trawler was seized by French officials, prompting the UK to summon Paris's ambassador in London, a move that's usually made against enemies and not allies. Paris threatened London with sanctions if the issue isn't resolved by the 2nd of November. The UK Foreign Secretary launched a counterattack against France, vowing legal action if Paris doesn't back down.
Well, France has made completely unacceptable threats, first of all to our fishermen, but also to the Channel Islands, in terms of their energy supply. And we need them to withdraw those threats. If they don't withdraw those threats, we are prepared to use the dispute resolution mechanism in the trade deal we signed with the EU to take action against the French.
It's unclear, it's always unclear as to who is correct or incorrect, but usually they are resolved in a peaceful, diplomatic manner. But we live in an age of a growing nationalism in which international institutions are breaking down. And so as a result, a minor spat over fishing rights is turning into into a major international crisis.
The threats have raised concerns about a larger trade dispute between two of Europe's largest economies.
Now, since the Brexit referendum 5 years ago, the UK has been facing a multitude of challenges and uncertainties, and those include the complications for freedom of movement, the Northern Ireland border, and not least of all, the economy. The fuel shortage last month was one instance suggesting the extent of the ramifications for Britain. Now, how's London trying to address those challenges, and is the Brexit deal with the EU enough to avert future disputes? Let's take a look.
The fishing issue was one of the key points dragging the Brexit talks. Although fishing constitutes a small portion of France and Britain's economies, it holds substantial political significance as it's the main lifeline for the coastal communities. Apart from the fishing disputes, the two countries have recently clashed over the AUKUS agreement, under which Australia ditched a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with France for a similar one with the US and UK. Britain's departure from the EU has also negatively affected its economy. Official data forecast a 4% economic slowdown for the country in the long run in the aftermath of its exit from the bloc, while the COVID-19 impact is estimated to cut Britain's gross domestic product by 2%. Brexit also cast doubts on the future of the 1998 Irish peace deal, as it would mean a hard border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. Although the two sides settled the issue, the agreement that has been implemented since January this year has led to the disruption of trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, causing disagreements between London and Brussels. The UK government now wants the deal rewritten. Experts believe the long lines and brawls at the fuel stations across Britain are going to be the new normal for life in the post-Brexit UK.
Now moving on, the death toll from twin blasts and gunfire in the Afghan capital has risen to 25. According to the Taliban, the explosion that took place outside a military hospital also left some 50 people wounded. A Taliban spokesman says the blast followed an assault by a group of gunmen. Four of the attackers were reportedly killed by security forces, while a fifth one was captured. No word on who was responsible for the carnage. But Daesh terrorists have ramped up attacks across Afghanistan since the Taliban's takeover in mid-August. The group has targeted mosques and other places with serial bombings, resulting in heavy civilian casualties. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به وقت حالا.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you might remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations on supporting the oppressed and fighting the oppressors, especially the global arrogance and Zionism. We will continue the discussion in this episode. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in his testament stresses that one of the main problems of the Islamic countries and oppressed nations are the mercenary regimes of these countries. He believes that these regimes try to keep these nations weak, backward, and dependent. He writes, at least for the recent 100 years, that the big world-devouring powers gradually put their steps in the Islamic countries and other small countries, we have witnessed or have been told by correct histories that none of the ruling governments in these countries have thought of their nation's freedom, independence, and welfare. Almost all of them have rather been engaged in oppression and suffocation of their nation or have only tried for their vested or group interests, or for the welfare of the wealthy and upper class, and the oppressed slum habiting classes have been denied all life blessings such as water and bread, and those miserable have been employed for the interest of the wealthy and debauchee stratum, or they have been the puppets of big powers, which have employed whatever they can to make countries and nations dependent and have made countries the markets of the East and the West through different tricks and have secured their interests and have raised nations backward and consumers, and they are moving with the same plan. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, the misery for Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West, and I emphatically recommend you not to listen to the propaganda horns of the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic, which all try to expel Islam from the scene so that the interests of the superpowers are secured. Imam Khomeini also writes, O you, the oppressed of the world, and you, the Islamic countries and Muslims of the world, stand up and grasp the right with hands and teeth, and do not be scared of the propaganda ballyhoo of superpowers and their servile stooges, and expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And you and the committed serving classes take the helms of affairs and gather together under the flag of Islam to rise up for defense against the enemies of Islam and the deprived of the world. Imam Khomeini believed that confronting the media hype of the oppressive power the main duty of Muslims. He writes, "Today and in the future, what must be important for the Iranian nation and the Muslims of the world is the foiling of the disuniting and destructive propaganda." Elsewhere in his testament, the Imam writes, "I recommend Muslims, particularly the Iranians in the current era, to show reaction against conspiracies, increase their solidarity and unity in any possible way, and disappoint the disbelievers and the hypocrites." Imam Khomeini says, "The prominent ulema and respectable preachers of the Islamic countries should invite governments to free themselves of dependence of big powers and come to mutual understanding with their nation, as in this way they will embrace victory. And let them invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to Islam. And let them shake the hands of fraternity with their brothers in faith in any country and from any race, because the great Islam has called them brothers. And if this brotherhood in faith materializes through the efforts of governments and nations with the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power in the world, with the hope of the day on which, God willing, this fraternity and equality will materialize." Imam Khomeini also writes, "I recommend the Islamic nations to take the role model of the Islamic Republic government and the Iranian struggling nation to put the oppressive governments in their place. If they do not capitulate to the will of their nations, the source of misery of Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West."
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Simple question.
Does it matter who owns English football clubs? Police are investigating a graphic banner displayed by Crystal Palace fans that targeted the Saudi Arabian takeover of Newcastle United. That banner focused on the Premier League's ownership test following Newcastle United's £305 million sale. It featured illustrations of a man dressed in Arabic clothing, alongside what appears to be chief executive of the Premier League, Richard Masters.
The sign listed offences the regime is accused of by human rights groups: terrorism, beheading, civil rights abuses, murder, censorship and persecution, which were all ticked off on a clipboard under the heading Premier League Owners Test. The Premier League's chief executive, Richard Masters, was also depicted giving a thumbs up to a bag of cash, standing in a pool of blood. Palace fan group Homesdale Fanatics has said it created the banner, which was shown during a recent football match. An accompanying statement said, "To give the thumbs up to this deal at a time when the Premier League is promoting inclusive initiatives shows the total hypocrisy at play and demonstrates the league's soulless agenda where profits trump all." Although the Premier League said it had received legal assurances from the new owners that the Saudi state would not control Newcastle United and there would be penalties if this is not true, others doubt this to be the case. While the impact of these huge investments has been league success, for example for Manchester City, thanks to Abu Dhabi investment money, there are claims that these massive money ventures are designed to create a positive impact for the image of wealthy Middle East dictators.
What does the public think of Saudi ownership of English football clubs? And why are these states so eager to buy British clubs in this way? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What does the public here in North London make of Saudi Arabia's human rights record? And do they even care? That's what we asked. Here's what they said.
I've not heard anything. I've heard of Saudi Arabia, but I know nothing about that.
I'm not an expert, but from what I've heard, at least on the women's rights side of things, it's pretty poor. It's pretty poor. Like listening to the news, I think probably they're taking small steps to, I guess, like as a kind of show to like, oh, look, we're doing this, but in reality, it's not good.
To be honest, I don't actually know a lot about that. That's something that hasn't really come up on my radar. I haven't got a clue, to be honest. I really don't have anything to say about that.
I mean, the thing about Saudi Arabia is they obviously have made some changes, things like, you know, the last few years, women being able to drive, other things, but there's a lot that still continues to be sort of hidden and under the surface, and some of their arms deals, for example, with Yemen and other things, you know, there are clearly a lot of things going on, not all of which, I mean, most things don't make the news and most things aren't very public, so.
I just know that it's appalling, yes, that's all.
I can't say I've ever actually thought about it. Maybe I should, and probably after this interview I'll go on my phone and do some Googling.
Not a good record. I've supported Amnesty International for many years, written quite a few letters about Saudi Arabia's record on this subject, so no.
I'm concerned about it, because it's not very good. As I understand it, I don't know enough about it to go into detail, but yeah, so yes, I am concerned about it.
I think it's poor, and I think giving them the opportunity to use the Premier League to kind of wash it out is a bad thing.
I wouldn't say that I'm, you know, terribly knowledgeable about it, but I know that they have the death penalty, and not much else. I know that their sort of leader was accused of the murder of a journalist recently, and that's about all. I don't think they've got great rights for women, would be my impression. But I'm not an expert on it at all.
No, at all. Yeah, it's not at all. Saudi Arabia is good, good country. It's Muslim country and it's good. And I don't know, I never heard any problem in Saudi Arabia. Are you good? Yeah.
I care about it because where I'm from as well, because I wasn't born here. So I'm in that part of the world where it's money talks, isn't it? That's all it is. It's just money. You know, I don't think they should be there anyway, to tell you the truth. Well, what should they?
What does the public think of Saudi-related state interests purchasing Newcastle United Football Club?
I mean, I think in general it's just sad how, rich owners are just, buying clubs. It feels like there's not really that closeness with fans anymore. You know, they're just they're different, just in a world of their own, spying success. And yeah, I think that is sad. Yeah,
I mean, sometimes people say that sport shouldn't be political, but I think that's they're making quite a big statement. I think they've also own quite a lot of other property and other things, don't they? It's not just the football club, various things that they own. And yeah, I don't really know what it's about, but I suppose it's having, gaining influence in various different countries and making agreements in order to make better trade deals, and a lot of it's about arms as well. So yeah, it's not great.
I'm a huge football fan. I'm obviously a Gooner because of the area I live in. I kind of sort of disagree with the amount of money in football in general. I think it should be a bit more like fantasy football, where you have a certain amount of money that's capped, and each team then has a set amount of money, because then it's fair. And then also the game is not about just the players, it's back about the sport. Whereas at the moment I feel like football is now just about how much money can one team spend on one player, and it becomes about an individual contest instead of the team sport. So I think, I don't think there's a problem with like Saudi Arabia or other kind of countries buying up football, because it's a global sport and it kind of spreads awareness of the Premier League and stuff. But I sort of disagree with the whole money aspect of the sport, really.
Very strong feelings about it. I'm aware of it, and worried about a country like Saudi Arabia infiltrating our sport. But sport is business, is money, isn't it? I mean, football is capitalism with a capital C, really, isn't it? So yeah, I mean, sad but true.
I think it's gross. And I think if you look at the amount of dirty money that's in UK politics and UK sport, especially football, it's not a good thing.
I'm a football fan myself. It's a bit tragic how they bought Newcastle Football Club. Surely Newcastle fans will disagree with me. If they look at their track record, I think it's quite concerning.
Oh, they have money. That's why they bought that big team. Yeah, that's good. That's good. They get money for that.
I guess it's a bit of a kick in the teeth. But I mean, I believe in like trade between different countries, and I don't believe in Brexit, so I'm not like in favour of not trading with other countries.
I think it's just dirty business of Saudi sheikhs, like let's say this, and it can be related some money laundering or something like that. In my opinion, I think this. And as you know, the papers, Pandora Papers, is maybe it's just related to each other.
I actually don't particularly like the fact that all the Premiership football clubs are owned now, by people who seem to run them for profit rather than, sort of the true fan base. So slightly disapproving view from that point of view. Obviously, from what you were touching on, their human rights record, that rings alarm bells as well. So overall, not a fan, I guess.
I mean, as long as it keeps the clubs running, I guess. That's quite good, I think. I'm not a pro, to be fair. Yeah, I think that could be great.
Deep down, I'm not really bothered, but it shouldn't be them, because they're taking over. Not in a bad way, I don't mean in a bad way, but it shows you money talks. It's all about money. He sold it for 300,000, 300 million, and look how much they're going to invest. But the fans want it, and that's it. It shows you at Crystal Palace with the banner, all the things they've done. They've highlighted it, that's it, really. I mean, I've done a Wells. What else do you want to know?
Football commentator Gary Neville has argued that Saudi Arabia's ownership of a British football club means that they're more likely to listen to human rights concerns, and that this could lead to an improvement in their human rights record. Does the public agree?
There's too much money in football to think that people would discover a conscience.
Not actually, because it's different things, yeah. But it can be some illegal things, I believe, because it's not easy to prove the source of money.
I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. Because obviously my life is completely different from these people who are able to financially buy a football club, so I wouldn't, it's not the same life, I would say.
I don't know. Their human rights is bad. So at the end of the day, I'm not the one who makes a decision. You know, their face should know better and the Premier should know better. But they must have went through it, didn't they? You know, the Premier should have allowed it, you know, but they don't really care either. It brings money into the Premiership, doesn't it?
I think you have to respect Gary Neville, who knows his football. I think sport has can have an impact on politics and for the good, but it's a bit of a tall order, isn't it?
I mean, I think it's wishful thinking. I don't think they're going to change the way that they treat people in that country because they brought Newcastle United. I don't see that happening.
I don't think it's going to make a difference. I mean, this is like a bit of fun for them, a bit of petty cash. I don't think buying a football team here is going to make any difference to the United States and Saudi Arabia.
I think the FA should have made a private inquiry about the takeover as well, the background of it, really. But it's sad that not many English-owning football clubs around the Premier League, and I think the FA should act upon it, and I think Phil Neville honestly should keep his comment to himself.
Well, who knows? Saudi Arabia is bad. I don't know. We're just people talk. Is that bad? Good. I don't think he's. Well, that is a businessman who buy that. It's not about his good country or not.
No, I wouldn't follow that school of thought. I like Gary Neville. Like, he's good, funny, but no, I don't think I would agree with him on that.
Completely different thing. I mean, it's the same with in many different countries where you hope that having some influence over human rights for being investing in that country or developing that country, but actually it doesn't work out like that. Yeah, no, I don't believe that argument.
On first thought, no. I think that seems a little bit optimistic. I think that the fact that they've bought a club, frankly, won't make a difference to that.
A quick look at the financial statistics tells the story. The Newcastle United deal cost its new Saudi owners £305 million. However, the money invested in just the players in Manchester City is estimated at over £1 billion. It's also estimated that 13 football clubs out of 20 in the Premier League are now wholly or mainly foreign-owned. The net worth of the Newcastle United owners is put at $250 billion.
In recent years, we've seen Saudi Arabia host British elite boxing matches, and now they've purchased a British football club. What, in the public's opinion, is behind Saudi Arabia's sudden interest in British sports?
Well, I think it goes back to, it's about the reputation. If they can get these massive fights, the whole world's watching. If they can get AJ, Usyk, Fury, it just seems like that's the place to be. There's some kind of, reputation, some standard there, which obviously there isn't, but that's what the money's buying, and it's a shame these sportsmen are going off and buying into it. So I think that's the main thing, it's a spectacle, getting an audience, a viewership there, making it seem like it's a place to be, but it's just money, and it comes back to money.
I guess if I had to say something off the top of my head, it's like I said earlier, where sport is a very big part of what we do. I mean, I live in Highbury and Islington, I've lived here all my life, and I've watched Arsenal matches and people streaming out of thousands and thousands of people, streaming out of Highbury Islington Station, walking down Highbury Fields to go see a sports match. And so if you think about it, the perhaps reach that you could get by affecting sports matches is pretty big.
I guess England has always, and Great Britain, because we're such an old nation, we have a lot of history here, and I definitely feel that a lot of countries like to buy in to the things that we have here in Great Britain because of our ancient theatre, our ancient sport, architecture, all that stuff. So I feel like Saudi Arabia and other countries do like to invest in Great Britain. It makes them feel like maybe that they have more of a historical background or backing behind them. Whereas in, if you're a relatively new country, development-wise, you sort of don't have that richness that we have here, I think, in more of a cultural aspect of richness, not as in like actual richness.
I do believe it's a business warfare. It's nothing to do with military. I think it's they're competing each other in the Middle East in terms of wealth and enterprises and business. I think they're trying to buy out clubs. Qatar bought PSG, United Arab Emirates bought Man City, and now you've got Saudi bought Newcastle, and I just feel like they're trying to buy clubs to compete each other and other businesses just to compete. If they don't get on the war field, they probably get on the business terms.
Well, I suppose Saudi Arabia's always had connections with English sport. I mean, I'm very, very connected with English racing. And is Sheikh Maktoum, is he from Saudi Arabia? I can't remember. Anyway, no. I can't think that there's anything more than the kudos of owning a Premier League football club. It's the best in the world.
I think it gives a element of legitimacy to them so that they get their foot through the door for other stuff. And I think if you look at football generally, it's quite a corrupt organisation, the way that it works from grassroots all the way up to the Premier League. You know, you look at the way Qatar got the World Cup and what's happened there. It's pretty despicable, to be perfectly honest. Right.
I'm an Arsenal fan, so you know what I mean? You know, so I've got the Americans here. And do they care? No. You know? But they've got the money, innit? Do what they want. You know, money talks. Trust me. If Viola was... No, I don't know. Now I work for these lot, don't I? So I don't know.
The Premier League has allowed Middle Eastern dictatorships to purchase Manchester City Football Club and now Newcastle United Football Club. Why would they allow this to happen? And what is the Premier League getting out of these arrangements?
I guess it's about who has the money to buy something, really. I guess it's not about where you're from. It's just about I couldn't buy a football club, for example. Maybe somebody else can buy a football club. Maybe they've got more to give to that, just because you're from somewhere else. I mean, I don't see the problem. I guess I don't see the problem. Like, is it because people here wanted to buy the football club, but then it's priced at a higher price, that's been sold overseas to somebody who can afford more? Is that the problem?
First thing that comes to mind would be money. You know, often a lot of these clubs and whatnot are quite greedy when it comes to money, and especially the people that have lots of money tend to want more money. And I feel like I can't see any other incentive other than just for the cash. that would be my opinion on that, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? I've got to be honest here. Saudi Arabia, they could come in and buy Newcastle, but they ain't going to take money. You can buy all the best players in the world. Doesn't mean they're going to click. They could buy them next week. Are they going to click? Your manager's going to come in. He might not do well. 6 months down the road, sack him, we get someone else. They could be pear-shaped. Look at Arsenal. Since Arsenal Wenger's left, right, they ain't sorted themselves out. Still struggling. You know, week in, week out, I'm a sad person because I'm an Arsenal fan. But money wouldn't help it. And I think they know that as well. They could pump in so much money into the club if they wanted to, but it's not going to do nothing. You know, you could buy all you want. It doesn't mean nothing. They could go next week in January sales and buy this player, that player, and that player. They might not click. And, you know, and the fans would turn on them, you know, turn on them again. You know, and they could walk out any time they want.
Injection of cash, of course. But how it will last, heaven knows. And, I mean, they had a tough enough run with, what was he called, the man who owned Sport Direct? Anyway, so they had a tough time with him. I mean, I think they're a very loyal fan base. They're called the Magpies, I think, aren't they? So good luck, but I'd keep a very open mind on this.
Things have been pretty hopeless for a lot of these clubs, haven't they? You know, and I could see from the way that the Newcastle fans were celebrating that they're excited about it, and you know, somebody's putting a lot of money into their club, and it'll lift them and raise their stakes in the Premiership and make life more interesting. But you know, there's another side to it as well, isn't there? So,
that is what Newcastle wants, right? Newcastle wants to be a powerhouse again, and that's what it will become. You know, it might not be the this season. Oh, it won't be this season. They might get relegated this season, but they will. They will build and they will become like a. You know, they'll get a conversation at the table like Man City have.
I think it's very strict. It's not very strict for this kind of issues because they have to put some restrictions. For example, they can ask the source of money. And actually, I don't like the English Football Association's acts for this kind of issues.
I just think it's tons of revenue in it, and the Middle East is very big on the Premier League, especially the world and globally as well. And if you cut off ties with a country due to the political reasons, they're going to cut off the funding and sponsorship, really. And I think the FA, they're trying to allow that to happen, really. And I think they're there for the money.
The most recent takeover in the Premier League of Newcastle United comes after the controversial go-ahead was given for a consortium led by Saudi Arabia's State Sovereign Wealth Fund, known as the Public Investment Fund, or PIF, to take control of Newcastle United in this £300 million deal.
Middle Eastern dictatorships have the money to invest vast sums on English football clubs, but with poor human rights records, this has created a dilemma that can't be resolved by simply pointing at Premier League success. However, it seems that according to the Premier League's ownership rules, when it comes to winning on investment or winning on human rights, the investment always comes first.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.